This is a very important week in the Jewish calendar. We are about to have Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. We're about to talk about the days which are very important in terms of our national calendar, in terms of our identity. The question that we should be dealing with, and this is something which has been raised and has triggered, it has been triggered in our consciousness over the last little bit, is the role of the diaspora Jew. In other words, all of us sitting in this room, who we may have been in Israel recently, we may have been in Israel for Pesach, but in the end of the day, we live, and we proudly live as Americans. Yes, I actually got naturalization just a few weeks ago. It didn't help with the accent. I did pass the test, and I have to tell you on a sidebar, what a fascinating country. I doubt that any elementary school kid even knows about all the civics of this country, but what an incredible country. Go into that another time. In the meantime, for all of us here living here in America, we've had to deal with a particular issue. And that issue is the following. Recently, as we've known, there's been a lot of attacks in Europe. There's been a lot of anti-Semitism, and following the attacks both in France and in Belgium, Prime Minister Netanyahu issued some statements talking about how Israel is the home of all Jews. So just to follow this through, on the second page is the New York Times article. I actually removed the picture of Netanyahu because I chose, of course, the most unflattering picture of Netanyahu in the New York Times, of course. In the bracketed off area, he says, Jews have been murdered again on European soil only because they were Jews, Mr. Netanyahu said in Sunday in Jerusalem. Of course, Jews deserve protection in every country, but we say to Jews, to our brothers and our sisters, Israel is your home, he added. But expressing the unease felt by many Jews abroad over such comments, I'm not sure how to pronounce this fellow's name, Yair Melchior, the Denmark's chief rabbi, said he was disappointed by Mr. Netanyahu's call. People from Denmark moved to Israel because they love Israel, because of Zionism, but not because of terrorism. Mr. Melchior told the Associated Press on Sunday, if the way we deal with terror is to run somewhere else, we should all run to a deserted island. Going further on the next page in this article, skipping the first bracket off, the second one is, apparently piqued by Mr. Netanyahu's remarks in January, President François Hollande in France pledged during a speech in Paris, Paris Holocaust Memorial, to protect all its citizens and told French Jews, your place is here, in your home, France is your country. On Sunday, the Danish Prime Minister, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, visited the Copenhagen synagogue where the attack took place and said, the Jewish community is large and an integrated part of Danish society. And the question you have to think about at the end of all of this is, who are we? Meaning, when we're living in this diaspora community, who are we? Where do we belong? Where are our allegiances? Similarly, in a Times of Israel article which captures the same dynamic, on page 5, in a bracketed off area, this is again Netanyahu's comment, to all Jews of France, all Jews of Europe, I would like to say Israel is not just the place in whose direction you pray, the state of Israel is your home. Benjamin Netanyahu said Saturday in Jerusalem, the day after an attack on a Paris kosher supermarket, randomly, that killed four Jewish men. This week, a special team of ministers will convene to advance steps in increasing immigration from France and other countries in Europe that are suffering from terrible anti-Semitism. All Jews who want to immigrate to Israel will be welcomed here warmly and with open arms. But for French Jews, the answer isn't so simple. The Israeli government stopped this Pavlovian response. Every time there's an attack against Jews in Europe, Rav Menachem Margol, the director of European Jewish Association, told the Israeli website news website NRG. So you have to think about this. You have to think about the debate that's going on, has been going on over this year. If I could just... Now, to be quite honest, you know, on a personal level, to me, this, you know, the statement of Netanyahu was actually quite a heartwarming one, because coming back to 1993, I remember as a child that at the time when the apartheid was ending, that Israel sent 10 LL planes. They earmarked 10 LL planes, which were empty, to be able to sit in the international airport through elections, in the worry that there would be riots, but the people were very concerned about the bloody uprisings that would ensue, and to save the Jews. Now, to me, that was a heartwarming thing, the fact that there was a way out. There was an escape hole because of Israel. But the issue is complicated, because think about it for a moment. Although it's true that when Netanyahu makes such statements, it enrages the French rabbonim and the French officials, then at the end of the day, let's just remember something. Where did those four families bury their dead? every single one of them took their dead to Israel. At the Copenhagen attack, when you look at a picture of that synagogue and all the flowers are laid outside, in and amongst the flowers is what? Is the Israeli flag. So the issue of Israel and the issue of Jewish identity seems very much linked. And as much as people are trying to extricate it and point out that this is a French issue, this is an anti-Semitism issue, in the end of the day, people are still identifying to some degree with Israel. It's somehow part of that fabric of their being. And the truth of the matter is, and at the end of the Times of Israel article, he says it's an older issue. He says that on page 6, the author of this article says, Netanyahu is hardly the first prime minister to ruffle feathers into the diaspora this way. In July 2004, then-premier Ariel Sharon irked French Jews with a similar call. If I have to advocate to our brothers in France, I will tell them one thing. Move to Israel as early as possible. It's interesting, by the way, that Sharon had such foresight. Meaning, you know, this is before the rise of the last 10 years, and he already said this statement. Sharon told a gathering of North American Jewish Federation leaders, I say to Jews all around the world, but I think it's a must and they have to move immediately. In response, nothing's changed. French President Jacques Chirac told Sharon that he was not welcome in France. So, history repeats itself again and again. What I'd like to point out is the following. This is an issue which we really need to address and think about, and I'm sure that we have, perhaps maybe not articulated it to a certain degree, is where do our allegiances lie? Where do our real allegiances lie? Is there a role, or is it really a role, or really is it a second-rate exile that we're in? Is there a role for being in the diaspora, or is it just nebuch, we can't make it to Israel, so we're living where we can't make it elsewhere? That's really the question that's at hand over here. But the question didn't start in 2004. The question started earlier, in 1949. If we go back a little bit further, in fact, there was a number of speeches that then Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion issued. Now remember, this is just after the birth of the State of Israel. 1949, and he is speaking on a number of occasions, and he said some comments which very, very much perturbed the American Jewish community at the time. Just to quote an article, I'm very thankful for about J.J. Schachter, who pointed to these next two articles on this issue. And this is an article by Tzvi Gannon called An Uneasy Relationship. At the beginning of the fourth chapter, it's called The Blaustein Ben-Gurion Understanding of 1950, which is on page 9. I bracketed off the second paragraph, and it says, an innocuous speech by Ben-Gurion in Tel Aviv in November 1949, reported in the New York Herald Tribune, aroused a hue and cry among non-Zionists in America. In it, the Prime Minister warned diaspora Zionists donors that the gifts would not give them any influence over Israel policies. A warning that was evidently directed at Abba Hillel Silva and his followers in the ZOA after they'd been accused by Morgenthau and Montors of trying to use American Jewish financial clout for such purposes. The main thrust of the speech was that Zionists need to adjust their thinking to the new reality of an independent, sovereign, and pioneer state. But this was not the point of the AJC member who wrote to Blaustein from Dallas, Texas. What bothered him was that the Prime Minister used the expression, Israel promotes the gathering of exiles from their dispersion, which the Texas member alleged proved that Ben-Gurion was going back on his assurances to Blaustein in October that he would call for the immigration of Israel of only a few American Jews with special technical skills. Who was Blaustein? Jacob Blaustein of the day, from Baltimore, was at the time the leader of the American Jewish Committee, AJC, and a very, very powerful person. A person so powerful at the time in the world of American Jewry that he was able to bring Ben-Gurion down to his knees. And Ben-Gurion had to reform the ideas that he talked about in his speeches in 1949 to the following. Just turn two pages, actually. You can see a picture of some of their meetings of Ben-Gurion and Mr. Jacob Blaustein in 51 there. You see on page 11 as they met at various occasions. But if you take a look on page 12, there's an article in The Jew in the Modern World, which is David Ben-Gurion and Jacob Blaustein. In it, Ben-Gurion is forced to reform his, we will call it, flagrant Zionism, as he was accused of issuing. And on the 13th page, you'll see, the pages on the leftmost bottom corner of the pages to see, this is David Ben-Gurion reforming his statement. Take a look at the bracketed parts. It is our great pride that our newly gained independence has enabled us in this small country to undertake the major share of the great and urgent task of providing permanent homes under conditions of full equality to hundreds of thousands of our brethren who cannot remain where they are and whose heart is set on rebuilding their lives in Israel. Skipping to the next paragraph. It is most unfortunate that since our state came into being, some confusion and misunderstanding should have arisen as regards to the relationship between Israel and the Jewish communities abroad, in particular, that of the United States. These misunderstandings are likely to alienate sympathies and create disharmony where friendship and close understanding are of vital necessity. To my mind, the position is perfectly clear. The Jews of the United States, as a community and as individuals, have only one political attachment, and that is to the United States of America. You can imagine what he must be thinking as he's saying this. I mean, you can imagine the pressure that David Ben-Gurion had to have above his head to say such a statement in a public address. They owe no political allegiance to Israel. In the first statement, which the representative of Israel made before the United Nations after admission to that international organization, he clearly stated, without any reservation, that the state of Israel represents and speaks only on behalf of its own citizens and in no way presumes to represent or speak in the name of the Jews or citizens of any other country. As a footnote, historically, it's fascinating that the Arab world didn't think the same way. Meaning to say, the incredibly vibrant communities in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, in Morocco, didn't get the same welcome as that Ben-Gurion's pointing out of it. He said, you know, Israel's one thing, and the Jews of the diaspora another thing. That's not what the Arabs said. There were 800,000 to 900,000 refugees from the world of Islam, of Jews, who had left centuries, millennia-old communities, because they didn't believe this. They understood that the identity of Jews were connected to the state. They didn't trust them, despite the fact that they would argue otherwise. In response, just to get a sense of this gentleman, Jacob Blaustein, if you turn the page, amidst his response, this is what Jacob Blaustein says. I'm just going to read the first two paragraphs. He says, while Israel, and you have to just appreciate the sarcasm here, while Israel has naturally placed some burdens on Jews elsewhere, particularly in America, he calls it burdens, right? That's the way he views the statehood of Israel. It has in turn meant much to Jews throughout the world, meaning it's a good thing in general. For hundreds of thousands in Europe and Africa and the Middle East, has provided a home in which they can attain their full stature of human dignity for the first time. In all Jews, it has inspired pride, admiration, and even in some instances, it has created passing headaches. Israel's rebirth and progress coming after the tragedy of European Jewry in the 1930s and World War II has done much to raise Jewish morale. Meaning, Israel isn't the solution to the Holocaust. It's a nice thing after the Holocaust, right? Meaning, as well as America, right? Jews in America and everywhere can be more proud than ever in their Jewishness. But we must, in a true spirit of friendliness, sound a note of caution to Israel and its leaders. Now that the birth pangs are over, I'm not sure that statement is warranted. Now that the birth pangs are over, and even though Israel is undergoing growing pains, that's apparently the next stage, it must recognize that that the matter of goodwill between its citizens and those of other countries is a two-way street. That Israel also has a responsibility in the situation, a responsibility in terms of not affecting adversely the sensibilities of Jews who are citizens of other states by what it says or does. That's a very important statement. Meaning, what Israel's policies say should not impact a person living, a Jew living in a foreign country. Right, as can be seen what's happening today. In this connection, you are the realists, and want facts. And I would be less than frank if I did not point out to you that American Jews vigorously repudiate any suggestion or implication that they are in exile. That's a very strong statement. Meaning to say, Ben-Gurion, don't get up on your soapbox and start telling us that this is about kibbutz golios and we need to come to Israel and this is about statehood, because in the end of the day, we're quite happy over here. And he was an extremely powerful person, and you can imagine that the Israeli Prime Minister had to bow and cringe in front of him to say the words that he said beforehand. You can imagine how powerful the power this man wielded. And in fact, later on in 1956, again the issue came up. And I'm not going to, for the sake of time, spend too much time on it, but you can see on page 17 and 18 a letter that David Ben-Gurion dated the 2nd of October 1956, reaffirms his statement of 1950 to Mr. Blaustein, because there were concerns about the way in which he was treating diaspora Jewry. And just turning the page at the end, Actually, let's just see over here. I'm going to start at the very bottom of page 17, actually. He reaffirms the statement which you just read, and he says, in confirming what I've said then, the last paragraph on page 17 and the first page of the letter, I think I need not repeat that I am myself an unrepentant Zionist. A Zionist, perhaps, of a kind different, entirely differently from any of those you know. For me, Zionism means to live in Israel, and personally to build there our new Jewish independent life, based on the teachings of our prophets, and on the conquests in science and technology achieved in the modern world. But other Zionists are entitled to their own interpretations of Zionism, just as Jews in different countries are free to hold varying views on what constitutes Jewishness, which is, by the way, something which is not perhaps they're entitled to. We discussed this a little while back. As Democrats, we can all agree in the most friendly way to differ on some points while rejoicing in many others on which we are in complete agreement. Yours sincerely, David Ben-Gurion. So you see the issue coming up again and again and again, and the tension that arises. And we may not perhaps feel that tension as strongly as Jacob Blaustein did, but there's certainly an element of it where the notion of, you know, of American Jews being a second-rate Jewry to Israel, and therefore what's their role? We have to, that's something we need to spend time thinking about our particular role. So in order to address this from the Torah, the Torah sources, this argument occurs even earlier. And that is at the beginning of what's called the Second Commonwealth. We're at a point now we'll call Shivas Tzion, Return to Zion, which is in a remarkable historic prophetic era that we're living in the last 70 years. But there happened to be another time where we had a similar, historically very similar occurrence, and that was the building of the Second Temple. Because of the building of the Second Temple, we'll remember that Israel didn't have independence. We weren't an independent state at the time. What happened was we were a subsection of the Persian Empire, and the Persian Empire's policy, instead of the Babylonian way of dealing with things, Babylonians were very black or white about things. They would kill everybody, and that's how they ruled. The Babylonians had a very fast rise, a very fast fall, and they were taken over by the Persian Empire, which ruled for many years. The Persian Empire had a better idea about things. They said, look, you know what we'll do is we'll reinstitute cultures of every nation that we control. When it talks about in Megillas Esther, 127 states, what it means to say is that what they did was they encultured those 127 diverse states to have their own rule, but they paid severe taxes to the Persian government. Persia controlled these countries as opposed to breaking the countries. So what they said is, look, you know, you have a Jewish homeland, there's Judea, we'll send you back, you'll make your temple, you'll do your things, we'll pay crazy taxes to us, we'll make sure that you make no political statements against us. But that's what's going to happen. And so therefore, for the first half of the Second Temple, we weren't a free state. But we were trying at the same time to come to Eretz Israel. Under the guidances of Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, there was Ezra, and there was later Nehemiah, who became the political leader. And it was at this time that what was fascinating is that there wasn't a great aliyah. There really wasn't. In Sefer Ezra, it talks about 42,000 Jews who came up, which is a fraction of the Jews of Bavel. And in this whole discussion, the Sefer Kuzari, in his second section, Rav Yehuda Halevi, discusses this whole episode. And he's explaining to there's a Socratic discussion between the Chaver, who's the wise Jewish man, and this Melech Kuzar, the king of the Khuzars, who's trying to convert to Judaism, and is trying to understand Jewish concepts. And they start talking about the land of Israel. And the Chaver, this Talmid Chacham, starts telling him about all the incredible levels of living in Israel. And he talks about all the Gemaras, about, you know, living in Israel, and if you don't live in Israel, it's as if you don't have a God, and all the different Gemaras that we've seen and heard. And then the Khuzari turns to him and he says, this is on the top of page 19, he says, Omar Khuzari im kein atama katzer b'chavas toroscha. If it's true, everything you're telling me, there's a full paragraph beforehand with all the statements about the importance of living in Israel. If that's true, then in the end of the day, you're not living up to it. You're not doing it justice, says the Khuzari. You're not living here. So, right? Rav Yehuda Halevi lived where? Lived in Spain. He lived in Toledo. That's where he was born. Right? So it says, you and the rest of the community are talking about all these great ideals, but in the end of the day, you're living in your diaspora communities. And he goes on to say, and this Melech Kuzar says, every religion, Islam, Christianity, all say there's an incredible importance about this land. So why is it that you're not there? Meaning, why isn't that you're not making every effort possible to get there? Says the Kuzari. Amar Kuzari, in paragraph Chav Dalet, Huvashtani Melech Kuzar, you've made me embarrassed. V'avon azeh hu asher mena'oi emenanu milahash miashlamas mash yaidanu boyalekem ba'ais sheni. This is the sin that in the second temple that we sinned, which made us not be able to reach the levels of prophecy which we're able to. Kumosh Omar in Zechariah Rani Basimchi Bastion, Zechariah living at the time of the rebuilding said that there should be a rejoicing of the Bastion, the daughters of Zion. Ki kvaraya inyan alaykim zuman vachul kasher batchila. It should have been like the beginning. It should have been like the rebuilding of the second temple should have been like the first. It should have been the same messianic level. Ilu hayo maskimim kulam lashuv benefesh chafetza. If everybody had agreed to come, aval shavu miksasan v'nisharu rubam v'gedolayim b'Bavel. The greatest leaders remained where? In Babylon. Rotsim b'golus uva'avoida shelo yifrudu mishkanoseihem v'inyonehem. They didn't want to leave their houses. They didn't want to leave their businesses. They had a good life and they stayed there. B'shem alzeh amar shlomo ani yishena v'libi er kumaya golus b'shena. Meaning it's like when Loshua Melech says in Shir Hashim, I'm sleeping but my heart's awake. Meaning the externalities of us are still sleeping. He says, I'm higher asmodas anavua. Called odi dofek kriyas elokim loshuv. When it talks about in Shir Hashirim, how the beloved hears the knocking of her beloved, that's God calling us to return. By the way, Rav Shachter argues that this in fact is, this is where, this line in the Khazari is where Rav Soloveitchik took the name of his book in 1956, or his essay called Kodel Didafek, referring to the Holocaust and to the return to Zion, based on this line in the Khuzari. And he goes on to say that what unfolds in Shir Hashirim is that the beloved is asleep, and Hashem, who represents the Doids, the beloved comes, knocks on the door, and it takes time for the raya, for the Knesset Yisrael, to wake up. And by the time we say we've taken off our shirt, and how can we get up? We're sleeping. And by the time we get to the door, the door is gone. That's the imagery of Shir Hashirim. Says the Khuzari, that's what happened in Bavel. There was an aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. It could have had the messianic potential that Zechariah was talking about. We missed it. We missed the boat. Why? Because we're quite happy in our diaspora communities. So coming back before David Ben-Gurion, coming back before Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon, many, many centuries ago, this is what occurred. But there's a reason why this occurred. There's a reason why this occurred. And this requires going back even further in history. So for this, I'd like to provide and think about two balances that we see in Jewish history. Two balances which are important to consider. The first is what is known as Darchei Shalom. There's a halacha, which is in the Mishnah, called Darchei Shalom, in which Jews have to provide for or seek out the peace of the country or the people or the nation that they're amongst. Where did this come from? So I'd like to quote for you to you from a very fascinating essay that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has in his book To Heal a Fractured World. He has a chapter called The Kindness of Strangers, and he expounds upon this in many, many, many different instances. Now, Jonathan Sacks says the following, just in the first highlight on page 20, he says, the ways of peace apply to idolaters, those opposed to everything we believe. Nonetheless, the sages ruled, we have basic responsibilities to them, not only the negative duty of not to harm them, but the positive duty of welfare. We have to provide them with food when they are hungry, financial support when they are poor, we must visit them when they are sick and comfort them when they are bereaved. That's actually a Mishnah. Now, in the next paragraph, he says, where did this idea come from? The rabbis derived it from a verse in the book of Proverbs, Fine. That is the textual warrant. Historically, however, it was born in the Jewish experience of exile. It emerged because Jews, having in the biblical era lived in their own land, were now dispersed minorities in pagan countries. Definitive in this context was the letter written 2600 years ago by the prophet Jeremiah to the exiles in Babylon and Egypt. Let's put this letter in context. Yirmiyahu the Hanavi, the prophet of doom, as everybody calls him. The person who is calling, he was blowing the whistle for years and years and years, and he said, Babylon is coming. Babylon is coming. Don't fight. Pay their taxes. Don't fight. Pay their taxes. You're not in the spiritual, you don't have the spiritual capacity right now to fight them. Don't fight them. And Israel didn't listen. Israel made an alliance with Egypt and with Assyria, and we were crushed. That led to the ultimate destruction of Babel. And Yirmiyahu kept on telling them, you're not up to the spiritual par that you think you are. You haven't got the right batting average. And then what happens? What happened is that it all occurred, and he witnessed it. Right? And Eicha is attributed to Yirmiyahu himself. So now people are now being exiled, and there are stages of exile as the Jews. First 10,000 of Jerusalem are taken to Babylon. Among them, Yechezkel is in the first stage before the Dimigdash is destroyed. What do you think Yirmiyahu should send in a letter to the Jews now in Babel? What do you think he should put into that letter as he's going to address the Jews of the newly found exile, which he warned about? What should he say? I don't want to say, I told you so. But I told you so. Meaning in the end of the day, right? I told you. I warned you. I shouted. You tried to kill me when I warned you. Now you're in exile. Okay, forget the personal vendetta. How would you think he should advise them to be able to survive what they're about to undergo? What possibly could he say which is going to ascertain their or guarantee their survival? Right, so meaning to shiva, re-identify yourselves, reconnect. He says the most remarkable statement. This is in Perek Chavtes in Yirmiyahu. He says the following. Listen, this is a translation of it. Build houses, settle down, plant vineyards and gardens and eat their fruit. Take wives and have children, seek the peace of the city in which you have been exiled. Pray to Hashem on its behalf, for in its peace you will find peace. Yirmiyahu says a remarkable thing. He says, in the goddess that you're in, seek the peace of the nation that you're in. Don't fight the identity of the place around you. This is a wise and far-sighted policy that shaped Jewish behavior from then to the present. Jews were to maintain their identity as Jews, but at the same time contribute to the societies to which they belonged. If belonging is not too generous a word to describe the marginal and disenfranchised existence to which Jews were often condemned. Very interesting point that he's saying. And here's the kicker. Jeremiah was no less a utopian than Yeshayahu and Micha. But on this occasion, his prophecy was pragmatic. It was necessary. 7 centuries later, so was the teaching of the sages of Darche Shalom, he's referring to. They had seen the failure of two other options. The first was assimilation, specifically Hellenization, the time of the Greeks. This robbed the Jews of their identity and led, as in the days of the Seleucids and the Maccabees, to the banning of religious practice. And the second was rebellion. In the last years of the Second Temple, and again 65 years later, at the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, these were the two most disastrous events of Jewish history, leading to defeat, disempowerment, and dispersion. Remembering Yirmiyahu, the sages formulated a third way, to sustain their faith through institutions that, unlike the Mikdash, could be established in anywhere, the synagogue, the school, the house of study, and the home. In the meanwhile, they would practice what today would be called active citizenship in the countries of the dispersion. They would give to others in need as well as to the members of their own community. The way of peace were not peace. Israel was in exile. The times were out of joint. But the diaspora Jewry could nonetheless create, if not peace, then at least the way that led to it. This is what our Jonathan Sachs argues. Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, the foresight that Yirmiyahu HaNavi had to be able to understand the survival of Jews in a godless reality, which those hundreds of years later the Rabbanim understood in the formulation of the halachas of Darche Shalom, were trying to preserve Jewish identity within the society that they were in. Very, very fascinating. And that's perhaps that might be the reason why it is so easy to fall over the edge when that identity takes over. When that identity of settling down in that country becomes the first person identity, not as Yirmiyahu was suggesting. This, in fact, is brought to the fore by Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk in a very, very famous piece he has in Parshas Bechukosai. Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, I put all the bios that I could find on the front page, so you can see that Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk lived in 1843 to 1926. Okay, so let's just put the dating correct on this. He lived in Divinsk. Okay, and this is what he says well before the Holocaust. He says the following. I'm not going to read the entire thing. He points out in the first section, it's on page 21. The Mishnah Chachma, Rav Meir Simcha Divinsk, points out the following. He says there's a general pattern in Jewish history. And that is that Israel, or the Jews, will arrive in a particular country, will settle down, will become part of that country, will start succeeding, and a wave will come. And that wave will send us out from that country. We'll have to find a new country with a foreign language. We won't understand how to live there. We'll work and work and work so our kids can succeed. Our kids will succeed. They'll become part of society. And just a short while later, a greater wave will come and move us again from that place. And unfortunately, history has shown, for century after century after century historically, that's what's happened. So he says the following, he says, and this is in the third column, there's a bracketed off area, about halfway down the page. It says, Kach yidarko shel ha'uma. This is the way of the nation. Shekasher yikonsul eretz nachriya, when they enter into a foreign land, yu einam b'nei Torah, they start off without any Torah founding. Kasher nidaldulu min ha'atzoras v'agzeros. As a function of all the suffering and the decrees that the vagerush and the expulsion that they had to suffer. V'achakach, yisorer bom ruach eloki, ha'shoev bom na'ashivam limkor chotzvo, machtzeves kudushosam. They want to return to their source, they want to return to their holy roots. Yilmudu yarbitzu Torah yasu niflois. They will have set up institutions. They'll have lots of Torah studied. Ad ki amod keren haTorah al rumah v'sio. And the Torah will be reestablished in the most magnificent institutions on its mountain. Haloi ein biyad haDor haChodesh lahosif ma lisgader neged avosam. But then what's going to happen is the following generation after the establishment of the Torah, well, you know, they're not going to be able to keep up to the same level. Ma yaseh chefetz haAdam ha'asu lisgader lachadesh. So what's the enterprising youth of the next generation, what they're gonna do? They're gonna look into other ideas. And they're gonna forget the history of the Jewish dispersion. Odd ma'at, in a little while, Yoshuv Lemor Sheker Nachlu Avosainu, they're gonna say, you know what? Our history, it's not altogether 100% true, the stories they tell. And they'll become very happy citizens of that country. They'll stop learning about the religion. They're going to start learning other languages, not theirs. They're going to learn from broken ways, not fixed ways. Yachshov. This is an unbelievable statement. Ki Berlin hi Yerushalayim. People start saying that Berlin is Jerusalem. Umukukolim shebohem asisem, and they will become like the worst of that nation. Kimutukolim lo asisem. Va'al tismach Yisrael agil ba'amim. He says, don't rejoice, Israel. Az yavoi ruach sarav asar, because another storm is coming. Ya'akor asom yigizo yanchenu legoy merachoy kasher lo ilomad l'shona. You're going to be taken to another shore where you're not going to know that language. Yoda ki hugar. And he goes on to say the same pattern will reinstitute itself. I mean, this is remarkable. This is before Nuremberg. He had the foresight that this person had over here. He died in 1926, right? The closest he saw of anything was the Balfour Declaration, 1924. This is what he was saying. What I think over here is this Meshech Chochmah is the foil to what Rabbi Sacks is saying. What's happening over here is the foil. Rabbi Sacks is saying that Yirmiyahu was saying it's important to become part of the society. It's important to contribute. It's important to be citizens of that society. What the Mishnah Chochmah is saying is sometimes what happens is that goes too far. And you lose the sense of identity and then you become too much a part of it. That's what the Mishnah Chochmah is saying over here. And it's important to weigh both of these because going too far on one extreme or too far on the other extreme is not going to be successful. But these need to be weighed against one another. One step further. And that is the following. On a spiritual level, on a very highly spiritual level. Recently, there was a sefer which came out called Hakitzav Rananu. Hakitzav Rananu, which means wake up and sing. This is a book written by Rav Chaim Cohen, who is known fondly by many as the Chalban, the milkman. He is a hidden Kabbalist, no longer hidden anymore. He gives shirim in Eretz Yisrael, very, very deeply profound individual. And he's written many books. One of his books famously is called Hakitzav Rananu, and it's about his The subtitle is the Hisorer Mitar Tardema Sagolus, to wake up from the sleep of exile, Leor HaGeula Hazorech Benishmosenu, to the light of the Geula which is arising in our souls. So this here in this section he delineates what he feels is what he calls Soda Golus, the foundation of what exile means. This is on a spiritual plane. Once again, are we going to share a tension in this? This is the perspective that he shares. Very interesting. V'nei Golus Yisrael me'aretzam hisod hamisa. When Israel is exiled, there's a certain sense of death involved in this. K'mevuah b'chazon atzmo seyveshos shagolusi beis hakforos, as Yechezkel talks about the valley of the dry bones. V'kein amru chachomim nimshalot tzion lemeisa shenema b'chav shakayim ha'heshivani k'meisei olam. Okay. Now, what does it mean? It's not just like he's not just throwing around the statement dead. Listen to the depth of what he means by the statement. It is a particular psychology he's identifying. Hamisa hi pirud aguf hashalem lerisisim. What death means is the division of a full body into pieces. Uvemashmaus shel klal Yisrael hi matzav boy noisarnu rak betzod hachitzonius shiachayim shel kol adam levadoi. In exile, we live a independent lifestyle as individuals, or even you might even say individual communities, but separate and disparate communities. Kishuv lahayinu guf echad ela evarim merusakim. We are dismembered joints in different countries, in different cities, and within one city. Ta'im nifradim zemizeh, cells which are separate from one another. Ba'arba ruchas ha'shamayim. And he quotes the Vilna Gaon, Kedivere Hagrab Yalkutim Shabasov Biura Lesafra de Tzniusa. The Vilna Gaon has a famous statement that he says the following. Ve'ein an itonu yodea adma. Although we don't have people among us who can explain what to do, ad yare alenu ruach mimorim, until there'll be a divine flow from heaven, kime'esha charo abayis yosa ruchenu ateres roshenu v'nish'arnu rak anachnu huguf shelo beloi nefesh. We remain a body without the soul within it that unite us. For Yetzir Lechusar, it's Hu HaKever. Entering into the diaspora, where the Vilna Gaon lived, is in fact, try to get to Eretz Yisrael, is the burial grounds. We have no way to protect ourselves. Mikol Makom, Hayu Chaburos V'Yeshivos Gedolos. We had great groups. We had great institutions. But they kept getting scattered. There was no continuity. What are the bones, says the Vilna Gaon? The bones are the Talmidei Chachamim, the people who can lead the generations, that at least in fractured parts there can be some form of identity. Mamidei Haguf, those which are the structure of the body. Until even the bones disappear into dust. When we ask for the resuscitation of the dead, we're asking for the fact that we can rebuild our, we'll call it communal body. The fact that we're able to have one identity as opposed to pieces that are lying up in different places and fractional pieces of a nation. The way that the Chalban understands it is that the diaspora reality is a fractured or piecemeal reality. As opposed to when we lived in the time of Geula, now you can argue whether or not we're living in the times of Geula, Aschalta de Geula or not. But in the end of the day, what Geula meant was the fact that there was one unity, there was one sense of nationhood. So you say at this point in time, you know, if this is what Golus means, you know, that's it, you know, it's terrible, that's horrific. So is there a benefit? Was there a role in Golus? Or was this all punishment? Was it all black? Was it all dark? Was it all in the shadow? So for this, to put intention over here, is I'd like to just revisit the words of another Kabbalist who lived just a little earlier, the pre-tzaddik, Rav Tzadok HaKohen Milubin. Rav Tzadok HaKohen grew up as a misnaged, a very, very sharp student, and he got involved in Chassidus, and eventually actually became the Rebbe of Ishbitz. Very, very, very prominent figure a century ago in Jewish thought. And he says the most remarkable statement. This statement is something which really puts in tension the statement of the Chalban that we just read. And that is the following. Golus Bavel, this is on page 24, in the bottom left corner, which is marked off in the Rav Tzadok. This is the pre-tzadok on Shmois, and he says it in many places. He says this in his commentary on Megillas Esther. He says it in the pre-tzadok many times throughout the beginning of Sefer Shmos. He says, "V'galus Bavel hayo hachana l'Torah sheba'al peh." The exile of Bavel, of Babylon, was the preparation for the Torah sheba'al peh. What Gomorrah do we study? We study the Talmud Bavli. I love to get onto the green books of the Art Scroll Talmud Yerushalmi, and there are many people who are doing that. But at the end of the day, what are we doing the daf for? We're learning the Talmud Bavli. See, he says that the exile of Bavel was the precursor or the necessary place to develop that learning. He says, as it says, Aboim Yashresh Yaakov, those who come will entrench Yaakov, El Talmidei Chachamim Sheba Bavel, Sheoise Tzitzim Uprachim LaTorah. That these are the Talmidei Chachamim of exile who produced the flowers of the Torah. Valze Omar, Umalu Panei Tevel Tanuva Shmisham Nispashet Torah Lechol Olam. That from Bavel was where Torah actually, the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah spread through the world. V'chein kol hagaloyos, and similarly all exiles, hu lispashtus Torah Shebal Peh, shekol hagaloyos bichlal Golos Bavel. The Golos of Bavel is simply the model for all the rest of the Golos Agaloyos that we're experiencing throughout history. And those Golos are therefore the prerequisite for the development of the Torah Shebal Peh. Rav Tzadok has a fascinating, fascinating theory, which really needs a lot more time than we have, and one day we can spend a little more time on it, that he understands that you notice that the proliferation or the development of the Torah Shebal Peh only started in Golos. Up till then, they didn't need the Torah Shebal Peh, the development part of it. The Torah Shebal Peh, let's make this clear. The Torah Shebal Peh, things like what tefillin is, what shape tefillin are, what the Priyei Tzadar is, that it's an esrog, that we got from Sinai. But the development, the drashas, the expansion of the Torah Shebal Peh into an axiomatic system only really started in the times of the Mishnah, which really was at the times of the Second Temple, which was essentially the beginning of, at the time of the continuation of Golos, which carried on through the redaction of the Mishnah in the year 200 to the redaction of the Talmud around the year 499, and the continued experience of those who wrote Torah Shebal Peh and developed the Torah Shebal Peh throughout the Golos. And he feels, and he understands, that the experience of the Jew through diaspora and the cultures that surrounded him were the catalyst to be able to develop that Torah Shebal Peh, to bring back what he understands is what he'll call the klipos. They're deeply embedded shards of a broken pottery edifice that we're bringing back from every country that we go through as we reconstitute that edifice of Torah Shebal Peh. The Torah which was given at Sinai was the potential pregnant Torah waiting to be developed, but it needed, unfortunately, the diaspora, at least perhaps as maybe a plan B, it needed that to be able to develop that and to reconstitute what it could have been to the pure edifice that we have today as at the end of this period of Golos. So again, once again, just to focus on what we did today, if you could turn back to the first page, just to get a sense of this notion. We focused on Netanyahu and the Jews and France. We went back to David Ben-Gurion and Jacob Blaussi, we saw a few articles. But then we said that this actually came back already, the tensions began at the times of the Sefer Kuzari, many years earlier, at the time of the Second Commonwealth, so Shivat Zion, the Second Beis HaMikdash. Where did this come from? And what we studied was the tension, of Rabbi Sachs points out, about the Chiddush that Yirmiyahu HaNavi brought to the idea of Darach Yisholem, later on as codified by the rabbis, of being a part of the society, and the danger that the Mishnah Chochmah brings of becoming too much a part of that society. On the spiritual level, we talked about the tension between what the Akitz of Aranand, or rather the Chalban, talks about, of the notion of Golos being a partial, fractured reality, and the notion that Rav Tzadok HaKohen talks about, of being there to reconstitute what you can get from that culture on a spiritual level, the Torah Shebal Peh. Once again, this hopefully is the introduction to this very complex topic that I feel that personally I struggle with, and I'm sure that many of us do. Thank you very much for listening.